know everything about this virus, and we really better be very careful, particularly when it comes to children, because the more and more we learn, we're seeing things about what this virus can do that we didn't see from the studies in China or in Europe. For example, right now, children presenting with COVID-19, who actually have a very strange inflammatory syndrome, very similar to Kawasaki's syndrome. I think we better be careful if we are not cavalier in thinking that children are completely immune to the deleterious effects.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, during his Senate testimony yesterday, describing the mysterious illness in children that may be linked to the coronavirus. CNN reports doctors in at least 17 states are investigating potential cases in about 150 children. Dr. Jackie Shmushkevich joins me now. She's a pediatric cardiologist and Kawasaki disease specialist at Children's Hospital here in Los Angeles. Four patients there have been diagnosed with pediatric inflammatory multisystem syndrome, or PIMS. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Madeline, and thank you so much for your help in raising awareness in our community.
Yeah. So PIMS, this is what is being called this mysterious illness associated with coronavirus?
So PIMS is short for pediatric inflammatory multisystem syndrome. And this does seem to be a new entity, which is potentially associated with COVID-19.
And what are the symptoms and what is the age range?
So when there are ill-appearing children who have high fever that persists, it's going on for 4 or 5 days or more, and they have other symptoms, which can include a rash. Sometimes the lips look very dry and red and cracked, or the tongue looks red. Some people say it's strawberry-looking tongue. The whites of the eyes are red. Sometimes the hands and feet are swollen or red, or there's an enlarged lymph node in the neck. These are all signs, together with fever, that we would very much encourage them to contact their pediatrician. Some children seem to be having more of a picture of abdominal pain or diarrhea with fever without another explanation. And another group we want to be particularly careful with is little infants who have fever for 7 or more days, and there is not another explanation identified.
And the general age range for this?
So the three patients that had a syndrome that appeared to present more like Kawasaki disease, the range of those patients was 8 months to 2 years of age. The other part of PIMS, the other end of the spectrum of PIMS, appears to be more of a shock-like syndrome, sometimes mimicking toxic shock syndrome. Those children in the other centers across the world seem to be in a little bit older age range. We have only had one patient at Children's Hospital Los Angeles that's in that shock range, and those seem to be more school-age children, but this is all changing very rapidly, so I hesitate to generalize.
Right. And do these patients also test positive for COVID-19?
None of these patients tested positive for the acute infection at the time they were admitted. When we check their antibody testing, the positive antibody test leads us to believe that these children had a prior infection with COVID-19, and the PIMS condition is likely a late inflammatory response to their previous acute infection.
Wow. And so do you have any idea when they may have had coronavirus to build up those antibodies? Or what is the time lag between having coronavirus and then having this later syndrome?
That is something that we're all working on to figure out together. And I'm confident that the multidisciplinary team at Children's Hospital Los Angeles will help to answer your question better in the days that are coming.
So are you going to go back now and look at the children who were diagnosed with Kawasaki disease, because you're saying that it's very similar, to then test them for COVID-19 antibodies?
Absolutely. Our Kawasaki disease team is now following up with all our patients who were diagnosed with Kawasaki disease beginning January 1st, and we'll be testing them all for antibodies.
How many patients did you have with that disease?
So since March 1st, we have seen 22 cases that presented with symptoms that looked like, at the time, Kawasaki disease to us, that we're now going back and looking at in more detail.
And so if a child does come down with this, what is the treatment for that child?
We're meeting as a multidisciplinary group every day to discuss each new patient so that we get input from all of our different subspecialists to make an individualized care plan for each child that will fit the picture that we see for each child, because this is so rapidly evolving, of course.
Yeah. What is the prognosis for children who have this disease? Is it treatable or fatal in some cases?
You know, we have a lot of experience treating this. Unfortunately, some children with Kawasaki disease can develop aneurysms in the coronary arteries, which can be a lifelong problem. I think that the other end of this spectrum, the shock spectrum, we're still learning a tremendous amount about, but those children are certainly in the much more ill category, often in critical care.
So a lot of parents might think, well, first of all, they're used to their children having fevers and they know how to treat it with Tylenol, etc. But they also might be afraid of actually going to the hospital where there might be kids sick with COVID or other people sick with COVID, that there might be an infection point. What can you say to them to give them a little more peace of mind if they do consider bringing their kid into the hospital?
Well, what I would say is that we screen every person carefully before they enter the hospital. Every inpatient, every child who's coming in for any type of procedure is screened for virus. And we have a universal masking protocol. So I want to make sure that parents know it's safe to come to Children's Hospital Los Angeles.
And at what point should they say, you know what, this is serious enough, I need to take my kid in?
I would ask them to work closely with their primary caregivers. And if they feel their child is very ill appearing and has had a high fever that's lasting for 4 or 5 days or more, and they see some of these other symptoms we're describing, please don't delay and please bring your child in for testing.
Dr. Jackie Shmushkovich at Children's Hospital, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Well, at this point, we all know what we should be doing to try to stop the spread of this virus. Stay home as much as possible. And when we do go out, wear a mask, stay 6 feet away from other people. But now that California is easing restrictions on businesses and public spaces, how safe is it to be out and about? Aaron Bromage is an immunologist and biology professor at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. He tackles many of these questions in a recent post that went, well, viral. It's called The Risks. Know them, avoid them. And Aaron joins me now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
Good, thanks. So the first sentence of your post says, it seems many people are breathing some relief and I'm not sure why. And is that because cases, when you take New York City out of it in the United States, are still going up?
Yeah. I mean, when you take out the two states that have, the largest outbreaks at the moment. So New York, and I know Massachusetts is not at the high, but it's my home state, so I know a lot about it. And they've tackled the outbreaks so well that now, cases are really plummeting down. But they were so big and they affected the national number. When you take them out of it and then you just look at what the rest of the country is doing, it's not as pretty a picture as it portrays. There's still quite a few states that are increasing and many more that are just plateauing right now, but yet they're going to reopen.
Yeah, so that's definitely happening here in California. And one of the things that LA has just done is reopen the beaches. You, in your post, you study the risk factors in various environments, indoor, outdoor. What are the risk factors for opening up beaches and other outdoor areas?
So I have to say with beaches, I'm incredibly biased. I surf year-round in Massachusetts, which is very much an accomplishment considering how cold it gets here in the water.
Yeah. So year-round.
Yep. I'm amazed at the wetsuit technology there is now. You know, when you start looking at just open-air environments like beaches and parks, as long as, you know, there is ample room for social distancing to create that physical space between you. When you're dealing with an outdoor environment and, you know, a gentle breeze and sort of the limitless dilution of whatever you can breathe out can just dissipate into the air, the risks are really low.
Like really low as in don't worry about it. You don't need to wear a mask. You can just be outside if there's a stiff breeze and you have limitless outdoor expanse.
You know, if you've got plenty of distance between you and the people that are near you, you don't, in my opinion, you don't need to wear a mask. If there are choke points in the area where you go out, so where people are funneled to come in closer to each other, then you should have a mask with you. And so, like, my family and I, when we head down to, you know, the beach to take the dog for a walk, you know, we just have essentially a neck sleeve that when we can't maintain social distance, we pull it up. And we just do our part to make other people feel comfortable and drop those respiratory emissions in those close contact situations when we are outdoors.
So when you're going for a walk outside and you see other people, and let's say one of those other people is a jogger who is huffing and puffing and runs right past you, should you take precautions? Should you be alarmed? Should you be angry at that runner?
Yeah, I mean, if they're coming past you so that, you know, you can feel their breeze of their body, they're too close. I mean, people should be smarter than that right now and should maintain that adequate distance. But, you know, when you have got, you know, 6 feet of space between you, if they run past, I mean, that is not where you should be spending your mental energy worrying about whether that person is going to infect you or not.
Okay, so a jogger, pretty low risk because that person is usually running by pretty quickly. You have written in your essay that part of the risk factor is the amount of time that you are exposed to someone. And so that would indicate that if you are indoors with someone, either in your family who might have it or in an office situation or anywhere else where the space is enclosed, then you're at higher risk.
Right. So in order to get infected, it's not just a single infectious viral particle. You've got to hit this infectious dose for you. And it's going to be different for each person, but the number doesn't really matter at this stage. What it means is you need to hit that number before you've got a chance of infection taking place. You can get that all in one go. Say someone that was infected sneezed on you or coughed on you or something like that. But you can also build up to that, you know, number, you know, over a period of 10 minutes if you're in face-to-face talking, you know, or over a period of half an hour or an hour if you're sharing an enclosed space with somebody. Just little bits add up to get to that number where you get the infectious dose.
So when you think of people returning to office spaces, what do you think is the safest way to do that?
So, I mean, we've got to start looking at our, you know, our support staff, the people that keep our work environment clean. They need to come out of the shadows and they need to be there in our workplace to keep surfaces clean. Then we need to start looking at how many people do you have inside, you know, an office or a work environment. And so we may be working with fewer people in the office, maybe people work in the afternoon and then a different shift comes in like in the morning and a different one in the afternoon. We've also got to do sort of some good engineering. We've got to think about our airflow. You know, are we being really energy efficient and recycling the same air over and over again? Or are we bringing in some makeup air from outside to, you know, maybe dilute down what's happening in there?
And is a 6 foot distance enough between workers in an enclosed space like an office?
You know, over a short period of time, if you're just having a brief conversation, it's certainly, you know, that's what is recommended and that's what people should do. But we do know that when it's not just a short period of time, maybe over a period of an hour or 6 hours that you're in, you know, a work environment, the risk starts increasing because of that recirculated air and the chances of, you know, the disease, even a really low dose of the virus, but breathed in over a long period of time, could you get you that number of getting an infectious dose that initiates infection in you?
What is that period of time?
So, you know, that I don't have a good answer with that. The only example that I can draw on right at the moment is with influenza studies, that they have shown that, you know, getting a low dose on one day and a low dose the next day is enough to establish an infection. We don't know that for this particular virus.
Right. And so I guess similarly with restaurants, that you don't want to spend a long time in a restaurant necessarily when they're recycling the air.
Right. And each restaurant is going to be, you know, going to be different. I was in Chicago a little while ago and got experience, you know, got into my first, I think it was a Japanese barbecue. I'd never been to one of those before, you know, and they've got the hot plate in front of you and a big exhaust fan up above you. And it's the, you know, the air is just being pulled out of there all the time. So that would be in my opinion, a much lower risk than what you would see if you're in a small, intimate restaurant where, you know, windows were closed and they were just recirculating the same air.
And how long in general does the virus hang about in the air? Like if somebody sneezes or speaks really loudly or sings, which is a way to expel it to a further distance than just merely talking, how long do the, if that person is ill, how long do those droplets hang about and can be inhaled by someone else?
Yeah, so droplets come in all shapes and sizes. And in those droplets, you can have, you know, the viral material. And, you know, if you've got a lot of virus in a heavy droplet, it drops out very, very quickly within a few seconds. The ones that are a little bit smaller hang around for a bit longer and travel a little bit further. But again, unfortunately, we're so new into this particular virus that while we have studies that show that it can be detected in the air in a hospital, in a sick patient's room, we don't know if it's actually intact infectious virus or just dead virus or if it's just the RNA. So we really need those studies to understand how long it can persist. But, you know, with a sneeze, it wouldn't be unreasonable to think that the smallest droplets are in the air for a few minutes.
Okay, so given what you know about how these droplets are spread and how long they stick around, where are the safest places to be versus the least safe places to be?
So any outdoor environment, and that includes, you know, restaurants, any outdoor environment where you can maintain space between people and, you know, you've got no interruption of airflow and that sort of stuff. So that can be on a city street, that can be in a park, it can be on a beach. And I know two great restaurants in my local area that have outdoor areas. You know, they can engineer these places to make them really safe. But it, as soon as you start funneling people closer together, more surfaces that they touch with their hands, and then, you know, again, limited airflow, that's when things start to get much higher in this risk factor of, you know, where you should spend your mental energy on just making sure that your hands aren't touching your face, that you don't spend a lot of time in that environment, just, you know, modifying your behavior to protect you.
Okay, and just finally, you wrote this essay for a small audience, and it's attracted millions of readers. Are you surprised by that?
I am just flabbergasted. I don't really understand what has happened. You know, I've been writing these posts for about 12 weeks, really to help me clarify my own thoughts about what was going on. But then I realized that, you know, I had friends and family that were just the same thing. They weren't quite sure what was happening and what they should do or believe. And so I started sharing them, you know, on Facebook. People like them. I don't understand. I didn't do anything different. I posted on Facebook and I had it on my own private blog and it just exploded.
Well, thank you. I found it very useful reading your essay. So and I'm sure a lot of other people did too.
I'm glad you did.
Aaron Bromage is an immunologist and a professor of biology at UMass Dartmouth, and his essay, The Risks, Know Them, Avoid Them, are at his website. Aaron, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Maybe you want to take a drive to the beach in a new car. If you're looking, now is a good time to buy, but really, who's looking? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Want to buy a new car? Well, for many of us, we're not really going anywhere, but for car dealerships and car companies, it's vital to attract new customers. Here in Los Angeles, dealerships are open. Some even let you test drive. But with 30 million Americans now out of work and others working from home, what will the auto industry have to do in order to survive? Rebecca Lindland is an independent car analyst and the founder and CEO of Rebecca Drives, and she's on the line now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, thanks for being here. What in general is the appetite these days for car buying? Are people flocking to car dealerships or no?
You know, the appetite, I think, is tentative. Consumers are interested and there is some pent-up demand going on, but they are also cautious about their own financial condition and also just what inventory is available at their local dealership, what inventory is coming in, because there's a lot of vehicles at port and on trailers that are that haven't been able to be delivered. So I think there's cautious optimism.
Right. So I can imagine that most people who are feeling a little uncertain about their future employment don't want to take on a big purchase like a car.
Well, exactly. And you know, if you were thinking about buying a car pre-pandemic, and nothing in your job or your financial condition has changed, it's actually a fantastic time to buy a car in many ways. Because sales are down so much, the dealers are willing to bargain. Now, this doesn't mean that you're going to walk out with a free car or something, but you're probably going to get a pretty good deal. Also, many, many of the manufacturers are offering some kind of incentive, whether it's a 3 months deferred payment or even extended warranties. They're offering some kind of financial incentive to purchase. On the flip side, if you were thinking of buying a car before and now your job has changed or there's a level of uncertainty in your financial picture, I would not embark on a new car purchase.
What if you want to sell your car? Who's buying?
So that's a really interesting question. The used car market is not doing particularly well. There is not a lot of demand for new or used cars. The auctions are actually not going on right now either. So there's not new inventory coming in. And while you would think that maybe that would mean that, you know, with supply low, demand would be high and prices would be high, demand's not high. So you're not going to get those high prices.
And what's happening with car manufacturers? Are they up and running? Are they, you know, going full force as they did before?
It depends. Some manufacturers are on their way to being up and running, but even geographically, that's different, both in the U.S. and on a global basis. So we may see some good news coming out of the U.K. or some parts of Asia. But in the U.S., where the vast majority of the cars that we buy are actually built, we are not seeing manufacturing begin quite yet. So we're still waiting. Obviously, you know, it's particularly in California, there was a lot of discussion about Tesla, which has now restarted production. So it really, you know, like so much, it depends.
Well, speaking of Tesla, there was this back and forth, as you mentioned, between Musk and the local county, Alameda County, about reopening. And he basically threatened to take the company out of California if he wasn't allowed to reopen. And then he just went ahead and reopened anyway. Briefly, what is this dispute over?
So this dispute really is over the definition of an essential business. So the federal and California state governments have a specific definition about the 16 essential businesses, which Tesla does qualify under that definition. Alameda County, however, particularly in this third order that they issued, kind of changed the definition a little bit and tightened up the definition, and Tesla no longer qualified as an essential business. That then causes conflict between state and local governments, and Tesla's complaint was really about whose jurisdiction are they operating under. They continue to be allowed to operate in San Joaquin Valley. They have not been able to operate under Alameda County, and so the complaint was about resolving that conflict.
In general, when people start going out again en masse and going back to work and all that kind of thing, do you think that they are going to want to be more in cars, given the fact that public transportation looks like a pretty effective means of distributing a virus? Do you think people will want to stay away from buses and trains and get into cars more?
The use of public transportation as people return to work is definitely going to be challenging. There is a perception of safety and a barrier to, I mean, it's self-isolation in your vehicle. This could really pose a problem, particularly for Southern California, where the traffic, of course, is epic, and there isn't a lot of public transportation anyway. There may be this kind of false sense of security of, if I drive to and from to work, I am limiting my exposure. The yin and the yang of this, though, is that you could also see an increase in not only traffic, which of course then leads to pollution, but also car crashes. And so this is one of the challenges as we move post-pandemic, is there's always this give and take between almost every side of the issues as we come out of the pandemic.
Rebecca Lindland is an independent car analyst and the founder and CEO of Rebecca Drives. Rebecca, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, our weekly Cooking with Evan segment. This week, an easy pasta recipe.
The pasta I use for this dish are little shells. So I thought, since we can't lay on the beach, we could look at a bowl of shells and turn our faces to the sun.
You don't even need a recipe. It's so easy. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. LA County beaches are open for limited activities like walking, swimming, surfing. And just in time, KCRW's Evan Kleinman is back with a recipe for what she calls beach pasta. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline.
Why is this called beach pasta?
For a couple of reasons. One, it's part of the group of pasta sauces that are made with raw tomatoes, so they're very emblematic of summertime. And also, the pasta I use for this dish are little shells. So I thought, since we can't lay on the beach, we could look at a bowl of shells and turn our faces to the sun.
That's so nice. But we can't eat at the beach. We're not supposed to stay and linger, just do some activities and get out.
Exactly.
Okay, so we can eat it before or after.
Right.
What is in this? And does it have a formal Italian name?
It's called Conchiglie della Spiaggia, which is just a name I made up.
It sounds so official.
This recipe is from Pasta Fresca, a book I wrote a million years ago with a woman named Viana Laplace. And this is, a lot of people know what pasta cheka is, which is tomato, mozzarella, and basil. So this is sort of in that vein. It's chopped raw tomatoes, which are coming to the markets as we speak. Some beautiful olive oil to get the juices of the tomatoes flowing, so to speak. Some torn basil leaves. I like to throw in a little parsley. And then tuna, canned tuna of your choice, either in water or in oil. And then I add some black olives, either Kalamata or Gaeta. And then I love anchovies, so I throw anchovy fillet in, but you don't have to. A little salt, black pepper, and you just let that marinate for at least an hour. And then you make your pasta, you drain your pasta, and you toss it all together.
I'm hearing snuffling from your dog in the background, Paco, which is great. Okay, so it intrigues me that you're doubling down on the fish. You've got tuna and anchovies in this.
Well, anchovies basically act as an accent. You know, we all hear about umami these days. And I like to think of anchovies as sea salt. They're just a deeper version of salt. And for people who are freaked out by them, you could definitely leave it out. But I think it adds just like a little something something to those sweet tomatoes.
Okay, so walk us through the prep for this, because like a summer beach day, it seems nice and simple.
So simple. So the most important thing, the hardest thing, is picking your tomatoes in this world that we live in. But if you're a person who manages to get to the farmer's market or has access to decent produce, just try and get some nice, big, ripe tomatoes. If you can't find them, then use some beautiful cherry tomatoes and just cut those in half. The ripe tomatoes you want to kind of cut into a half-inch dice. Literally, you're going to tear the basil. If you tear basil instead of cut it, it doesn't go black as quickly. Chop up a few parsley leaves, throw that in. Open up a couple cans of tuna, flake them into the bowl, the olives, the anchovies. And then you just want to drizzle enough olive oil over it to almost cover the tomatoes. It's going to be between a half to one cup, and don't stint on the oil, because the oil is what is going to cause all of these flavors of different ingredients to meld together, much like cooking would, but you don't have to cook.
So like a cup of oil?
I would add a cup of oil if I'm using four or five big tomatoes. Yeah. But okay. This is the kind of thing where you can just judge it with your eye. Basically, you're making a salad, really. Mm-hmm. And but the pasta is not cold. The pasta you make hot. So there is really no such thing as pasta salad in Italy. The closest they get is this, where you pair hot, freshly made pasta with a room temperature sauce.
I have to agree with them. I find pasta salad pretty disgusting.
Disgusting.
Yeah. It's just not flavorful.
It's wrong. It's culturally wrong.
Thank you. Thank you for validating my disgust. I appreciate that.
Anytime.
So do you serve this at room temperature then?
Yeah, I serve it at room temperature. If you want to make the sauce in advance and you feel more comfortable putting it in the fridge, that's fine. Just remember to take it out in enough time to allow the olive oil to come back to room temperature, because you don't want like seized up olive oil in your pasta dish.
And can you do this with other greens like arugula?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about these recipes that are based on raw tomatoes and olive oil is that they are endlessly variable. You know, if you like capers, add them. Hate anchovies, leave them out. You don't have basil or parsley, but you have a green onion or arugula, great, use that. No tuna, but you have tons of sardines you haven't used yet, or some canned salmon, do that. And if you're quarantining alone, one tomato and one of those little cans of tuna will work.
Hmm. Is there anything that's non-negotiable?
Pasta and tomatoes and olive oil. Those three things. You must have olive oil. You must have tomatoes, and you must have something to pour it over. So, and for the actual pasta shape, shells come in many different sizes. What you're looking for is the medium one. There are tiny little shells that are usually used for soup. And actually, that would be hilarious to use that kind, particularly if you have a child for this dish. And then there's giant shells that are usually stuffed and then baked. But you're looking for something in the middle, something that's about an inch long.
Okay. That sounds very simple and doable. I don't even think I need to read the recipe.
You don't really, but I did write it.
Summer day.
Just like a summer day.
All right. Well, enjoy. And Paco, you enjoy the summer too.
You too.
Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
And joining me now is Warren Olney, host of To The Point, the podcast. Hello, Warren.
Hello, Madeline.
How are you, and what's on your show this week?
I'm well, thank you. Hope you are as well. We're going to talk about two things, the post office and COVID-19. With regard to the post office, it's out of money. President Trump has appointed a Republican fundraiser to be Postmaster General. What does all that have to do with voting by mail, this coming election, and of course with the post office itself? And beyond that, COVID-19 has led us all to recognize these essential workers that we have taken for granted for so long, all for the way from the farm workers to the people who deliver things to your door. Will this finally lead to the kind of economic dignity that Martin Luther King Jr. called for as long ago as 1968?
Okay, timely and important stuff as always. To The Point, the podcast. Get it wherever you get your podcasts. Warren, thank you.
Thank you.
By the way, if you want Evan Kleiman's recipe for beach pasta, it's online at kcrw.com/beachpasta. Coming up, we'll have your Friday film reviews a day early next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, KCRW is covering the governor's noontime press conference tomorrow, so we're preempted by Gavin Newsom. So we're going to talk movies today. They're still coming out, even while you're staying in. Joining me to talk about a few of them is Christy Lemire. She writes for RogerEbert.com and co-hosts the podcast Breakfast All Day. Hello, Christy.
Hello. How are you?
I am fine, thank you. And also here, Katie Walsh. She reviews films for the Tribune News Service and the LA Times. Hi, Katie.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great. Okay, let's begin with Capone. This is a biopic of the famous mobster, Al Capone. He's played by Tom Hardy. The film is directed by Josh Trank. Here's a clip.
Do you know what the difference is between Adolf Hitler and Al Capone? Hitler's dead. Capone lives like a king in Florida.
He has full-blown dementia.
I have reason to believe that could all be an elaborate act.
What's this about?
We have information that your client may have tucked away a very large sum of money.
All right, Christy, let's begin with you. I guess this is a biopic. Is it true to the facts as we know them?
Who knows and who cares? That's not what matters here at all. What matters is this insane performance that Tom Hardy is putting in. And I so wish that clip had included whatever he is doing with his voice. He sounds kind of like Billy Bob Thornton in Sling Blade. He sounds kind of like Gollum. It's like gravelly and nasally. And I don't know, is it supposed to be funny? I truly don't know. It is so fascinating. This movie is so terrible, but it must be seen. And Tom Hardy, you know, he is notorious for really giving it his all. He digs deep. He delivers these very physical performances, very methody, rich performances, kind of in the tradition of a Marlon Brando, for example. And I'm really baffled by the choices he's making here. This takes place during the final year of Al Capone's life, when he's just rattling around this giant, tacky Mediterranean monstrosity of a house in Florida. And a lot of it is in his imagination. You know, a lot of it, you don't know whether it's the result of dementia or him remembering something that truly happened. And Josh Trank, this is supposedly a rebound for him from what happened with his version of Fantastic Four a few years back. And he wrote it and he directed it. And I understand it's a very personal project for him. I just do not know what he's going for here because there is so much unintentional hilarity.
Well, part of that, just from looking at the trailer, is the makeup on Tom Hardy.
There's a lot of old man makeup. There's a lot of him soiling himself with some extremely vivid sound design. Yeah. And like, again, is that supposed to be funny? Is it a poop joke? Are we meant to feel sorry for him? It's just very, very confusing. A lot of weird choices here. And yeah, I got to say, like, you got to see this.
Okay. So it's a car crash of a movie you have to watch. Do you agree, Katie, that you have to see this?
You know, I have to disagree with Christy. I do think the movie is terrible, but I do not think it must be seen. I think it must not be seen. This movie is incredibly grotesque. There is a sort of violent scatological theme that runs throughout the film as Capone's body is deteriorating and declining. He's having strokes. He's going further and further into dementia. And he has these really violent flashbacks. And it just feels like a very angry, despairing film to me. I didn't find it really funny at all, although whatever Tom Hardy is doing is fascinating for sure. But it's more of an interesting insight into sort of this young filmmaker's career and sort of where he was mentally and emotionally after everything that happened with Fantastic Four, which was this really high profile Marvel film or through Fox. That went down in this blaze of incredibly bad reviews and studio interference and rumors about what was going on set. And he quit a Star Wars movie. So it kind of gives you a little bit of insight into perhaps what he was thinking. And he said that Capone has been a, obsession for him since childhood. So it's just like a really strange, I mean, I did not enjoy the experience of watching this film at all. It's quite nightmarish, at least it was for me. But if it does anything successfully, it does place you in that, dementia mindset, gripped by these like horrible, violent memories of Al Capone. So if that sounds like something that you want to experience, then go for it. But really, I feel like this movie is kind of like a big middle finger at the establishment.
I will say, if I may add, Linda Cardellini's actually good in this. And what she's trying to do as Al Capone's wife is really tough because she's trying to deliver an emotionally grounded performance opposite just this wild man like Tasmanian devil that she has to act with. And she's trying to bring realism to it. And her character deals with so much verbal and awful emotional abuse. And she is good, but she's like in a totally different movie from Tom Hardy.
But that's a cliche in all of these mobster movies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a definite skip on Katie's part.
Sorry. If you want to see what the hype and the craziness is all about, like, vaya con Dios. I can't give you my recommendation, but, good luck.
And if you dare, where would you see Capone?
Capone is available on Amazon Prime and Google Play for a 48-hour rental. I think it's about $10.
All right. Let's move on to How to Build a Girl. Katie, you saw this one, and this one seems completely different. This is based on journalist Caitlin Moran's semi-autobiographical novel, also titled How to Build a Girl. And here is a bit from the trailer.
I'm Johanna Morrigan. I have an interview for the job. Did you think my writing was good?
It's not really us.
Not cool. Johanna Morrigan is dead. This is the legendary Dolly Wilde. Last night, rock and roll meant nothing to me. By midnight, it was the most important thing in the world.
Okay, Katie, what is this one about?
So I was right in the target audience for this film just because I loved Caitlin Moran's book so much. I think it's a really great book, not just about being a teenage girl, but about being a writer and about being a critic. And so Beanie Feldstein plays Johanna, who is this dreamer living in a small town in Midlands, England, and she wants to write and just get out of her town. And she has this very imaginative sort of fantasy life. And she ends up writing for a music magazine in the early 90s in England, when all of those music magazines were a huge deal. She writes under this pen name named Dolly Wilde, and she becomes this giant caricature, wearing a top hat and these crazy outfits, and she becomes notorious for writing these really scathing reviews. And she's a teenager, she's partying with all the music editors and hanging out with musicians and stuff. But I think this is a really lovely adaptation, and it's super lively and funny and bright. Beanie Feldstein is the perfect person to play this role. And I think the film is just, you know, it's a great coming of age story, and it's a great film about, you know, what it means to make yourself, whether that's like through a persona, and hopefully the person comes through. And also just about being a writer and being a critic and taking responsibility for the work that you do.
Yeah.
And she really nails the Midlands accent, I have to say.
Right, she's American, right? That must have been difficult.
Yeah, it's a very specific, like, regional English accent. So she nailed it. She did a great job with it.
And for people who don't know, Beanie Feldstein is the star in Booksmart. She was also in Lady Bird. In both of those, she played teenage girls, kind of geeky teenage girls. So it seems to me that's her niche right now.
Yeah, it's definitely a sweet spot for her. But she also, you know, as the Dolly Wilde persona, she gets to be this really sort of like outlandish, hard partying character. And she really takes to it. And the film is, you know, really like sort of irreverent and funny, and also has like sexy, funny moments and really touching, moving moments as well. So I think that where, you know, the character ends up is obviously, you know, in a great place, but she goes through a whole wild ride to get there. And I think it's just a really insightful film about what it means to sort of like figure out who you are.
And where can we see this movie?
You know, this film was released on VOD by IFC, and IFC is also releasing all their films in drive-ins, which is really cool. So this was playing at the Mission Tiki drive-in out in Montclair. But yeah, it's on all the VOD platforms and on demand, I believe. So,
okay. Moving on to Mother's Little Helpers. This premiered at Sundance last year, but it's being released on demand now. It's about a mother who finds out she's dying. Her four estranged adult kids come back to be with her, and here's a clip from the trailer.
I just want to be sure that she's dying before we really commit to going out.
I think that's a really good point.
Fish out of water breathing? What is that?
Yep, that's the breathing.
Jude, what are you doing?
That's what you came back here for.
Okay, Christy, sounds like this is a plot we have seen and heard before. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, so it's a movie about, you know, as a parent who's dying and the siblings who come together to deal with that, and then, of course, work through their own decades of resentments and missed opportunities and mistakes. Kestrin Pantera directed this, co-wrote it with the rest of the cast, and she stars in it as one of the siblings. It's three sisters and a brother. And Melanie Hetzel plays their mom, who was like kind of a 70s folk music, kind of rock and roll type hanger-on person. And it's how they reach a point of forgiveness and catharsis over the years of, you know, her neglectful parenting, and you know, they're all in flux in their own lives. It is, as you point out, a bit of a cliche, the notion of this, but there's real emotional intelligence here, and there's an authenticity to it, and there's a dark humor that allows them to navigate some of the tricky scenes, which kind of rang true for me. You know, I found in my own family that when times are hard, you rely on laughter to get through, you know, and that's very helpful, and they all have sort of a dark humor to them. So I liked it. You know, I was a little distracted by the casting of Melanie Hetzel as their mom, because she's really not old enough, and they don't do a whole lot in terms of trying to age her in terms of makeup, what have you. But I know this is a personal story for Kestrin Pantera. It's inspired by some events in her own life, and the intimacy of that is quite evident.
Katie, what did you think?
Yeah, I think Kestrin Pantera does a lot with a little. So, like you guys said, you know, it's a story that we've seen before. It's a one setting film. They're basically all in this one house, but I think that she makes it really sort of interesting and dynamic with the cinematography, with the authenticity in the dialogue, and you know, as Christy mentioned, and with the editing and some sort of like lyrical flashbacks to childhood. So I think she makes it like really creative and interesting film to watch with a story that we've seen before. And I think she's a really great actress. I think that the character she plays is this really sort of like grounded, sardonic figure who's kind of the one responsible one of the siblings. And then she has a really great cast, including Melanie Hutzel, but also Breida Wool, who's a great actress, plays one of her sisters. And I've always loved watching Breida. I think she's like a really interesting actress, and she plays sort of the flighty, like not reliable sister. So I think the dynamic she creates and like you said, has emotional intelligence, makes it worth watching.
Okay. Mother's Little Helpers. And where can you see that?
That's streaming. That's in a few places, including Amazon and Google Play.
Okay. Excellent. All right. Well, thank you both.
Thank you.
Christy Lemire writes for RogerEbert.com, and she co-hosts the podcast Breakfast All Day. Katie Walsh reviews films for the Tribune News Service and the Los Angeles Times. And that will do it for us today. Tomorrow we will be airing Governor Newsom's press conference, so tune in for that. I'll be anchoring that live. Until then, I'll see you tomorrow.